From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And Jeremy, two extraordinary political battles are playing out today. Democrats in control of the House are holding their first hearing to grill a member of President Trump's cabinet. And acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker is in the hot seat on Capitol Hill today.
And Amazon and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos accusing the publisher of the National Enquirer, a tabloid owned by a friend of President Trump, of trying to blackmail him with embarrassing photos for political reasons. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
Okay, let's start with this Jeff Bezos story, which broke last night. Just an unbelievable story. American Media, Inc., which is the parent company of the National Enquirer, said in a statement this morning that it acted lawfully in investigating Bezos and that its board will promptly and thoroughly investigate Bezos' claims and take whatever action is necessary. The publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, a friend of President Trump's, is on that board. Rick, what do you make of this whole story?
Well, in the cooperation agreement that David Pecker and AMI have with prosecutors in New York, stemming from the Stormy Daniels incidents, it all adds up to something much bigger even than the potential revelations that Bezos put in this extraordinary column that he wrote for Medium. And it gets to kind of the basics of how journalism is committed and how favors are traded, and it does potentially impact the president of the United States himself. We know his relationship with Mr. Pecker and with the National Enquirer have been very supportive in the past. Bezos even says maybe the Saudis were involved. So, well, it's an extraordinary showdown with the richest man in the world and maybe the most popular tabloid in the world.
Okay, let's get to the Saudi connection for a second, because this is really interesting that Bezos claims in the Medium post that the publisher of the Enquirer was livid about the Washington Post's coverage of the death of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, which many believe, including the CIA, was ordered by a close Trump ally, a close friend of Jared Kushner's, that would be the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and that they wanted the Post to stop the investigation or they'd publish more photos in the Enquirer of Bezos. Aisha, where does all this lead, do you think? What's the next step here?
It's not really clear. This whole thing regarding the Saudis and them being upset about coverage of Khashoggi, this is a big issue because you do have the White House kind of taking this line that they still want to work with the Saudis and not necessarily going along with what some intelligence have found about the involvement of the Crown Prince. And so you have all of that going on, and you have a president who doesn't like the Washington Post reporting very much either. And he had kind of talked about some of AMI's earlier reporting on Bezos that kind of led to this divorce proceedings for Bezos and his wife. So you have all of these kind of interesting characters involved. Now, not the White House is not involved at this point, but you have all of these very powerful people who have been fighting each other for a long time and now kind of really throwing very serious accusations at each other.
Rick, I was just checking the president's Twitter feed. No response to this story yet. Have we heard anything from the White House or anyone from his inner circle?
No comment that I'm aware of formally on this. And maybe not necessary for them to comment at this particular juncture. This appears to be between Mr. Bezos and the National Enquirer and its lawyers. But the next move would appear to belong at some part to the Enquirer. And how do they respond to this extraordinary series of accusations? And where else does Bezos take this? We know they've been investigating actively how they obtained the photos that are alleged in this email exchange, how they obtained the text messages that appear to show an infidelity that may be breaking up his marriage. So there's a lot that has to play out there before I think we hear from the president next.
Okay, so the other big story today in Washington, Matthew Whitaker in the hot seat on Capitol Hill this morning. House Judiciary Committee Chairman, a Democrat, Jerry Nadler, asked Whitaker if he gave sensitive information about the Russia investigation to the president after Whitaker was briefed on the special counsel's work.
I'm sorry.
It's a yes or no question. Have you communicated anything you learned in that briefing about the investigation to President Trump, yes or no?
Mr. Chairman, as I've said earlier today in my opening remarks, I do not intend today to talk about my private conversations with the President of the United States. But to answer your question, I have not talked to the President of the United States about the special counsel's investigation.
And the backstory here is that Whitaker agreed to appear today only after Democrats on the committee backed off of this threat that they wanted to subpoena him if he tried to claim executive privilege. Aisha, have we learned anything from this hearing today?
Well, we've learned Whitaker is going on the record, and this is important. It is a crime to lie to Congress, but he's going on the record saying that he hasn't discussed the investigation with anyone at the White House. So this Russia investigation, that he is not kind of going back or being a back channel for the White House. And so he's trying to make that clear. There have been some fireworks between Whitaker and Democrats on this panel, so it's not clear that this is going to really end here and whether there will be more questions raised by this hearing. But he is making the case that he is handling this investigation appropriately.
Rick, this is not the only hearing going on this week with the new Democratic chairman. There was also one about Trump's tax returns yesterday. President Trump is calling these investigations presidential harassment. This is, by the way, from a president who spent many years dogging President Obama about his supposed not American citizenship or his birthplace. What about this claim of presidential harassment?
No president likes to be investigated, and the president even fired a warning shot of sorts at his State of the Union address, basically saying the Democrats would be responsible if government drives to a halt because of investigations. That said, Democrats' view is that they were elected to provide oversight. They are not going to stop holding hearings on the president's taxes or on anything surrounding the Mueller investigation in Russia just because the president says, you're harassing me. If anything, it's going to make them dig in more. That said, there's a big caution flag that's been set up by leadership and throughout the party that while a lot of folks want to rush and immediately put those tax forms online, don't keep looking for that PDF form to just pop up in your inbox. They want to make sure this is done deliberately. And if maybe more relevantly on the Russia front, if we get to a point where the people start talking about impeachment, they want to approve the pretext for that. So they want this to go actually a lot more slowly than it may look given the flurry of activity this week.
So much happening in Virginia this week. Yeah. Aisha, let me just go to you on this because Ralph Northam, still the governor in Virginia, even after admitting to dressing in blackface a long time ago. Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor, has been accused of sexual assault. The attorney general also admitted to dressing in blackface. Now there's a Republican, the Senate leader, who edited a yearbook with blackface photos. What's going to happen in Virginia? Or do you think that Northam is going to stick around? And now that he's made it through these first few days, and it turns out there are so many other people have done similar things there in high positions of power in Virginia, that he'll just stay in power?
I am not a psychic, and so I wouldn't. And at this point, I don't think anyone should take bets on what's happening in Virginia, because I don't think anyone could have foreseen this happening. But I think with Governor Northam, I think that he has benefited from all of these other scandals coming out. And before all of these other things came out, the idea that he would have made it even to today would have been shocking. But I think because all of these kind of other skeletons in people's closets are coming out, that he has been able to hold on because there isn't really a clear line for what will happen next. If he has to go, then does the attorney general need to go? And then what happens with Fairfax? People are calling for investigations. So once this investigation is done, does Fairfax survive that? So with all of these questions, it seems like everyone is just kind of holding on right now, and no one's giving in and no one's leaving. And so I don't know how long that can last, but right now, that seems to be the state of play.
Rick, what do you think? I was just looking at the Richmond Times-Dispatch newspaper this morning, and in some ways it looks like business is going on as usual in Virginia. Lawmakers cut a deal with the governor related to a tax issue. Does it seem to you like Democrats are trying to find a way to preserve one of these top three politicians so that they could keep the governor's seat?
That may be the default position, just because the alternative would be that much worse, to put a Republican in office when you have the top three elected leaders there. I think at this stage, it's maybe more likely than not that the governor holds on. There aren't enough pressures that can be brought to bear necessarily to make him change his mind. And because of the flaws identified or potential flaws, alleged flaws, in the other two folks that might take his place, it might be that the only thing that saves Ralph Northam is that the other alternatives are worse. Mm. And the fact that he's hung on a full week against all the odds, nothing else forces him out. He's got 3 years left on that term.
Who won the week in 2020 Democratic presidential politics? Elizabeth Warren's supposed to announce tomorrow, but she's dealing with even more revelations about listing herself as American Indian decades ago. Amy Klobuchar may make an announcement on Sunday about whether she's in. Beto O'Rourke was back in the news because of an interview with Oprah. Aisha, just a few seconds here. What do you think?
I actually think the person who probably won and is not in the running right now is Stacey Abrams. That she gave the response to the State of the Union and didn't mess it up. Which
no negative headlines for Stacey Abrams.
So I think she's the winner, even though she's not in the race.
Except I did see a question about whether she might have been standing in front of a green screen. They're trying to figure that out on Twitter. Aisha Roscoe at NPR, Rick Klein at ABC. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Venezuelan-born conductor Carlos Izcaray has been closely watching the political crisis in his native country. He's the music director of the Alabama Symphony Orchestra. And 15 years ago, he was arrested at a protest in Caracas and tortured by forces loyal to then-President Hugo Chavez. We asked him to put together a list of music that's helping him cope with today's crisis, as opposition leader Juan Guaido challenges the legitimacy of President Nicolas Maduro. Top of his list... Symphony No. 10 by Soviet-era composer Dmitri Shostakovich. Carlos Izcaray joins us now from Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we asked you for some of the music that you're turning to as your country endures this political upheaval. That one was a very turbulent piece of music. Why did you pick it?
This is a piece that was written just after the death of one of the worst tyrants in history, Stalin. And of course, Shostakovich had to endure many, many years under this regime. The movement that you're playing, the second one, it's got this militaristic, highly volcanic energy to it that is very much attuned to the frustration that many of us Venezuelans feel. And if you listen to the end of the piece, there is hope at the end of the storm.
That storm you're talking about is very personal to you. As we said, you were arrested and you were tortured in Venezuela some years ago under the Hugo Chavez regime. This was in 2004. Can you tell us what happened?
That is right. I was tortured in 2004, detained, kidnapped by the National Guard, and I went through, well, very bad mistreatment of all sorts, physical and psychological, threatened to death. And what I went through is what many people are going through now in Venezuela. We're talking about students who are leading the marches. We're talking about political prisoners, et cetera, et cetera.
When you were in that dark period of your life, imprisoned and tortured, what was your relationship with music, and did you turn to it?
Well, very good question. The first thing is I entered a quite a depressive state when I turned away from music. This was going to be the week that I was going to have my big debut with the National Symphony Orchestra as a conductor. So it was everything was shattered. But after a brief period of just darkness, my friends and my family, my father especially, brought music back to the equation for me. And it was a way to heal, both literally physically, because I had nerve damage in my arm, you know, playing the cello. I'm a cellist, so by playing music, I got better. I think that since then I've understood many of the layers that were until then not discovered by me of the power of music.
Let's hear another piece on your list. This is Four Motets on a Christmas Theme by Francis Poulenc. Speaking of healing, this is very peaceful.
This is a piece that, to me, every time I listen to it, I just it's like rediscovering the miracle that is music. It's a spiritual piece. It's just sheer beauty. I just think this piece elevates me to a different frequency. Hard to describe it, and it's just a couple of minutes long. But I really think that Francis Poulenc captured the most intimate and profound elements of what it is to be a human being and its relationship with music.
Which is needed for many people in your country right now. Another sorrowful piece on your playlist, Bach's Suite No. 5 in C minor for cello. Now, you studied the cello at El Sistema. This is the world-famous, publicly-financed music education in Venezuela. How does that settle with you today, that in some ways, at least, you are a product of the state that tortured you?
Yeah, I actually started as a violinist in El Sistema, and eventually I changed to cello, and I studied that here in the U.S. as well. I did all my high school and college here, but this particular movement is quite a sad piece, but at the same time, again, it's a sort of bittersweet. It's sad, but it's beautiful. It's very, very simple, and it's a way for me to connect with the instrument. On top of that, having worked with many, 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 I'm talking hundreds, if not thousands, of the young musicians who are products of El Sistema, it is infuriating for me to see how over the last years this system has been turned into a propaganda machine. This is since the Chavez years and then the subsequent years as well. So something that was very pure and very much focused on, you know, bringing culture to people of all strata, well, it was turned into a propaganda machine by a dictatorial regime that wanted to have a good face in front of all the crimes that they were committing, you know, behind it.
Okay, it's not all classical that you're listening to now. How about Pray for Rain by the English electronic music duo Massive Attack? And their eyes change. And then there's Ocean Drive by the German electronic music ensemble Brandt Brouwer Frick. Carlos, these are upbeat.
They're definitely in motion, I would say. I'd like to characterize myself at least as a man of action. No matter how down and somber I like to be, I personally enjoy the rhythmic part of it. I'm an urban kid, so I see electronic music in many ways like urban drums. It's a way to reconnect with some primitive aspect of what we are as a people and as individuals. But this music, as I said, there's a little bit of a funk to them, but it gets you going at the same time, so you're not completely petrified.
Hmm. Speaking of drumming, you're also listening to some Afro-Venezuelan beats. I'm imagining when you hear that, you hear of home, and I'm sure you're thinking of home a lot these days and your family that's still in Venezuela.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about home. I'm thinking about my family. I'm thinking about my friend and their families and all the things that they're having to endure. A lot of this music, Afro-Venezuelan music, comes obviously from former slave communities. It is so full of power and sorrow at the same time, but at the end, it is also a celebration of humanity. This is music that is meant to be cathartic. It's impossible not to be in a sort of trance when you're listening to it, and eventually people start dancing around the drums. So this is very much attuned to the energy of what's going on now with Venezuelan society. It's a volcanic energy of what's going on there.
As you've been talking, I just can't help but think that so many times throughout the history of humanity, really, crisis and chaos and upheaval creates great music. I just wonder if you're thinking about that at all. You know, what could come out of this difficult time?
Well, absolutely. We wouldn't have an Eroica symphony were it not for the political climate in Europe and Napoleon and Beethoven's reactions to it. We wouldn't have the Shostakovich works. At least they would be very different pieces were it not for the dictatorship that Shostakovich had to live through.
Do you think something like that might come out of today's crisis?
I am certain of it. I'm certain that it's already happening.
Before I let you go, I want to play one more piece of music. You know what that is.
Absolutely.
The Venezuelan anthem.
I must say, as a musician, it's one of the best anthems in the world. Musically speaking, it's not your normal sort of militaristic band tune. It's got more layers of complexity, musically speaking.
But I hear you, and I also hear some patriotism in your voice.
There is something about it, and I must say that I'm not your typical Venezuelan patriot. I'm very critical of my country or anywhere where I've lived. But there is something. Now I've been looking at the lyrics of the national anthem in Venezuela. They are so much attuned to everything what is happening now. We're a free people. We're a brave people. That's the first thing that says, Gloria al bravo pueblo, glory to the courageous people. It's all about bringing down oppression and living in a free society. So the more I read it and listen to it, the more I feel that it's a great anthem, and I'm something that definitely gives me extra energy to move ahead and fight for those who are suffering everything in Venezuela.
Carlos Izcaray, music director of the Alabama Symphony Orchestra and the American Youth Symphony in Los Angeles, also a native of Venezuela. Carlos, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Almost 2 billion people depend on water from the Himalayas. But according to a new report, at least one-third of the Himalayan glaciers that supply the region with fresh water will be gone by the year 2100, even if the world keeps making deep cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. That could mean flooding and then prolonged droughts in countries including China, India, Nepal, and Pakistan. Lori Vasily worked on that report for the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development. She's with us from Kathmandu, Nepal. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And what kind of impact will that have for these glaciers to melt so much by the year 2100?
Oh, it will have massive impact in this region. In this region, the Hindu Kush Himalayan region actually spans across 8 countries from the west, Afghanistan, to the farthest east of this mountain range is actually in Southeast Asia, in Myanmar. Between a quarter and a third of the human population on this planet depend on the water resources from the mountains in this region. So it's a critically important resource, of course, for the region, but a global resource also. And when those glaciers disappear, it wreaks havoc on agriculture, on food security, water security, on lives and livelihoods across the region.
And is this purely an effect of climate change?
Well, you know, I mean, a combination, of course, climate change, land use changes across the region, greenhouse gases. But yes, what happens, there's this interesting effect called high altitude elevation dependent warming. So warming increases at higher elevations. So you've got the glaciers, you've got the ice, you've got the snowpack. And so if the warming is greater in those areas, then the ice and snow, which actually act as water storage, diminish because they melt, and that melt then for the first period will be greater, but then predicted after 2050, the meltwater will be less, and that meltwater feeds into the river supply across the 10 major Asian rivers.
How much are you feeling this right now? You're joining us from Kathmandu. You know, the headline number here is 2100. The year 2100, you'll see a third of these glaciers melted. But what about now? Do you already see it?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, the amount of glacial change is really significant. So more investment in this region really needs to be made in terms of ensuring that there's more glaciology monitoring so we understand the threat of these glacial lake outburst floods is there. And unless we have some understanding of the baseline around all of these different glaciers and we do more remote sensing, but also on the ground mapping of the glaciers, you know, unless we do that, we won't be able to take the preventive actions that help communities to move out of areas in case they're at risk in the face of disaster of a glacial lake outburst flood.
That is Laurie Vassily with the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development. We'll link you to more about the report at hereandnow.org. Laurie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Last year, the number of police officers who killed themselves in the United States was higher than the number who died in the line of duty. We've been following this issue, and nowhere is it more staggering than in Chicago. Since last July, at least five officers have killed themselves, and the Department of Justice says the suicide rate for the Chicago PD is 60% higher than the national average. And now there may be a sixth death. Chicago police say they're investigating whether an off-duty officer took her own life last weekend. Carrie Steiner is well aware of this problem. She's a retired Chicago police officer and now a psychologist who runs the First Responders Wellness Center in Lombard, Illinois. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there are now reports potentially of yet another officer in Chicago who has taken her life. What is going on there? Do you have any theories?
I think that there's many reasons why officers, particularly in Chicago, are taking their lives. And one of them is that they see a significant amount of trauma, more so than most officers do, and even compared to Los Angeles and New York City. The crime rate is very high and the murder rate is very high. And there's something called cumulative trauma. So when you're constantly seeing trauma, one might not bother you so much, but when you see it the 10th time or the 20th time, that can start to be overwhelming. And I know as an officer myself that I never really felt like that was impacting me so much until I was able to take a step back and then realize that so much of how I started to think and process things had changed since I became a police officer. Because you can't, as an officer, think that I can trust everybody and everybody's going to tell me the truth. Mm. Otherwise, you can be hurt. So you have to automatically start thinking that people might be out to hurt you, something bad might happen. Unfortunately, that is a negative way to view the world. I had a Chicago police officer talk to me the other day and said that her night was very easy because only one person had been stabbed and one person went to the hospital over a domestic violence situation. Now, I think most officers would feel like if somebody had been stabbed and somebody was beat up so bad that they went to the hospital, that they would be more upset. But yet in Chicago, it's so common that they feel like it's not.
Forgive me if this is an inelegant way to ask this question, but do you get the feeling at all that what's happening in Chicago is that these suicides are somehow contagious, that one officer sees a colleague doing it, and then he or she decides that maybe they feel the same way?
Well, I guess two things. Is one, I unfortunately, there is something to say about that suicides are contagious because the aspect that if somebody else did it, it gives you more comfortability in saying, well, I could do it too. But the other thing is that I'm not really sure I feel like there's a substantial increase in the amount of officers committing suicide in Chicago. because when I started in 1998, there were three officers in my district that committed suicide. My very first day that I went to work, I attended an officer's wake who had committed suicide. I know 18 officers that have killed themselves. That's not all the officers that in Chicago that have. Those are the officers that I know. And so I think that this has been an ongoing problem. It just, I think, is being, the light is coming out a little bit more.
Well, to that point, the Chicago PD acknowledges that this is a crisis and has been public about it. It released this video that we're going to listen to now in 2017 that tries to make the point for officers that it's stressful work, and it's not only stressful on the streets, but it's stressful at home.
Officer, I need you to come see me in my office. It's a civil lawsuit.
Some believe the chant refers to putting police officers in body bags.
I'm not going to jail.
So, as a former officer, I'm sure you can relate to some of what you're hearing there.
Absolutely.
Is this sort of effort by the Chicago PD effective?
Well, I think that there are some great things that the Chicago Police Department are doing, but I think that there's areas that they could improve. And one of the things that I think is a problem for all law enforcement is that there's a culture that it's not okay to need psychological help. And some of the reasons make sense is because you wouldn't want to have somebody with a gun if you feel like they're not mentally stable. However, I think what most law enforcement departments need to do is normalize that there are going to be some normal emotions that go along with things and to have a better understanding of that.
Well, this brings us to what you do. You've started this wellness center. You are a former cop. And, you know, this is unique because these are first responders getting help from their peers, people who have been in their shoes before. How much of a difference does that make?
Well, I've been told by all of the officers that I see that that is the only reason why they came and saw me.
Why? Because they feel like they couldn't trust a therapist who didn't know the world the way someone like you does?
Absolutely. I think that there's many things. I think officers are very worried that if they share how they are feeling, that they're going to be involuntarily committed or that they would get a fitness for duty evaluation because they're not stable enough to have their job. So going for treatment for an officer is very, you know, scary for them because they have all of these things that could possibly happen. They also are scared, what if something gets back to the department? Will they think that I can't handle my job? Also, the Chicago Police Department does random drug testing, and they're also afraid, what if I'm on an antidepressant? Will that come up? And if so, then what happens to my livelihood and my job?
And what do you tell them that makes them feel better?
Well, what I try to do is I give them actually the statutes and the correct information about confidentiality, fitness for duties, as well as they are not testing for psychotropic medications on the drug scans. So having that information and that they also understand that I'm not going to take something out of context. I understand the police world and the police culture. And so if they say something off the cuff, I'm not going to automatically assume that they're going to try to go and kill somebody. And I think that they're afraid that an average therapist might do that. They might jump the gun because they do have access to a gun or a weapon. So if they say, I am kind of feeling suicidal, will that therapist then jump the gun and say, okay, I need my guns taken away from me and I need to be committed into the hospital?
Let's talk about that issue. The police have regular access to their service weapons, not only when they're on the job, but when they go home.
Yes.
Is that something that needs to be addressed?
Well, I think that most officers, you know, need their weapons, feel comfortable with their weapons. And again, doing the police job and being in Chicago, you have to live in Chicago. So I don't think that that's the problem. I think that the problem is that you need to make sure that officers are understanding how to get treatment for themselves and what signs and symptoms are something that is concerning enough that you should go and get treatment.
One more thing I want to ask you. How do high-profile police shooting cases affect the emotional well-being of a force? I'm thinking in Chicago, where you are, the shooting death of Laquan McDonald in 2014. The officer involved was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to prison recently. It was a huge national story. How does it affect the people who are out on the streets trying to enforce the law?
I think it affects officers very much because I think that most officers are trying to do the right thing at all times. And so to constantly be under scrutiny takes a lot of stress and pressure on officers. So what I hear from most officers is that they feel in some ways that they need to take a step back and just respond to calls instead of being proactive because they're not sure how that might be taken in the court of law or by their superiors. And so they feel in some ways that they're actually less proactive but more reactive, and that's not very good for our culture.
That's Carrie Steiner, a former Chicago police officer and now a psychologist and owner of the First Responders Wellness Center in Lombard, Illinois. Carrie, thanks for your time. Do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And just one more note on this story. Chicago PD Superintendent Eddie Johnson says his department will have 11 counselors on staff later this spring. In 2017, the Justice Department reported that there were just 3 counselors on staff for a department of more than 13,000.
An update now on the measles outbreak in Washington state. There are now at least 55 confirmed cases, most of them in Clark County, where 20% of school-aged children are not vaccinated for the disease. Public health officials in Clark County say the outbreak was 100% preventable. Meanwhile, area clinics are scrambling to keep up with sudden demand for the vaccine. We'll keep an eye on that story. Meanwhile, in Nashville, a new ballet premiering tonight poses a provocative question. Did William Shakespeare have a black lover? And was the dark lady mentioned in Shakespeare's sonnets a brothel owner from the late 16th century in London called Black Lucy? That mystery became the subject of the 2015 book Lucy Negro Redux, which is now coming to the stage. Craig Havighurst of member station WMOT in Tennessee reports.
It began because 31-year-old poet Caroline Randall Williams loves Shakespeare's sonnets.
My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red. And her lips red.
When Williams read about an English professor at the University of Chichester who'd found circumstantial evidence tying William Shakespeare to Lucy the brothel owner, Williams flew to England to meet him and make the mystery her own.
She was a historical figure, but she's also, more importantly, this bigger picture idea about the reality of being a dark lady in the world.
Lucy shows up in 16th century court documents related to her business. Other accounts place her and her employees at an upscale Christmastime revelry in 1594, where Shakespeare staged a comedy of errors, and sonnets 127 to 154 are sensual tributes to a mistress.
If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head.
Out of all that, Williams and the Nashville Ballet conceive a plausible truth.
Really, that truth is embodied in, you know, Rhiannon gives Lucy music, Kayla gives Lucy a body, I give Lucy words.
Kayla is Nashville dancer Kayla Rouser, one of the few African-American lead ballerinas at work in the U.S. today. And Rhiannon is roots music star Rhiannon Giddens, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops. She jumped at the chance to work on the ballet because it engages the issues she's been focused on since winning a 2017 MacArthur Fellowship.
Who is this woman who might have inspired some of the most beautiful poetry that we know of? And what does that mean for me as a black woman? You know, these are the questions that she kind of posits in this poetry.
Giddens and collaborator Francesco Turisi, a pianist and percussionist, conjure a hybrid soundscape for a hybrid production. With Renaissance modes and drums, Southern old time and the blues, plus snippets of opera and jazz.
Each character has a theme. Each character's relationship has its own theme, you know. So these are all instrumental things. And then there was the idea of setting some of Caroline's poetry to music.
Say she wild, that she live by it, that she like it. Like that money, like that witness, like that grotesque in his yes, yes. And she dazzle him when she monkey shine, 'cause of how she know
that he know his people shamed of how he go for them darker juices.
Besides speaking for Lucy, Williams also plays a kind of blues woman Greek chorus throughout the ballet, guiding the audience, says artistic director and choreographer Paul Vasterling.
And through her, we meet Shakespeare, who's in love with her.
Then a love triangle ensues with another figure from the sonnets, the fair youth. Shakespeare has an affair with him.
And the question is, does she really, really care?
The point being, Lucy is above such concerns. She's presented as a woman with agency and autonomy. Kayla Rauser suggested dancing the entire ballet on point, her position of strength, Vasterling says.
It's a very interesting challenge, I guess, to figure out how we present this character, Lucy, in a modern sensibility. A woman of now, a woman who is independent and who is at home in her beauty. And she's a woman of color at home in her beauty. And she doesn't really need a man to define her.
Defining Lucy could well be the subtitle of the work. Poet Caroline Randall Williams, who's the daughter of novelist Alice Randall, made that possible by blurring the roles of the historian, the creative writer, and the ardent Shakespeare fan.
Here's a black body that was meant to be this color in this time and this space. And let's consider it. Let's invite that notion. Let's give a woman in that time my face and see how audiences experience it. See how that makes me feel a new claim to something that I have loved for so long.
Meanwhile, Paul Vasterling, a gay man, was struck by the inclusive implications of Shakespeare's ardor for the fair youth.
I'm really excited about telling a brand new story in ballet, and a story that I think, that I hope, will be relevant to people, not only to women of color, because it's about that, but to people who feel othered, to people who feel outside, you know, and who have tried to figure out their, I guess, their value in the world, their ability to be loved by another, and claiming the power of their own beauty.
Lucy Negro Redux, the book, is currently out of print, but it's being republished by Third Man Books this week in conjunction with the stage production. For NPR News, I'm Craig Havokhurst in Nashville.
Skin the color of daddy done wrong.
Nashville Public Radio provided music for this story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
Promise, take space, stay awake, space, baby, break it, space. Now, Lucy.